This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to explore my curiosities through combos with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Zohar Atkins. Zohar is a rabbi and thinker. He's the author of two Substacks and the host of the Meditations podcast, all of which are in the show notes. Zohar and I talk about academia, Judaism, content creation, and bridging philosophy and religion. Please enjoy.
I consider myself a lifelong learner. I've always pursued the life of the mind and the life of teaching, which for me, the two go hand in hand, teaching and learning, because the best way to learn is to teach. And the best way to teach is to model excitement for learning. I had a very studious academic career at first. I did 4 years at Brown and pursued a master's concurrently with a bachelor's. And then I went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. I did a PhD. My interests were in history and philosophy and literature. Basically, like, I wanted to read the entire great books curriculum. And I did that. And I thought I wanted to be a professor. But along the way, I felt like academia isn't really the place where love of learning always happens. I found it was quite politicized and sort of careerist, and I wanted to do something more creative and less in the box. And so I was always passionate about religion and spirituality and my Judaism as well. Because when I was 17 and I went to Israel on a summer fellowship called the Bronfen Youth Fellowship, that was one of my first experiences as a young adult where I really felt like the love of learning emphasized, as opposed to, let's say, learning for the sake of doing well on a test or, you know, impressing a teacher, padding the resume or whatever. And so it always felt to me natural that, like, religion was a place where the focus was on the things that matter, as opposed to the sort of more superficial aspects that I guess dominated my competitive high school. I mean, I had a good high school experience at Montclair High, which is public, but it was kind of a competitive place where people were focused on getting into Ivy League schools. And I think along the way, the question of, like, why are we reading these books? What wisdom do they have to offer was probably given short shrift, despite, you know, I had a couple good teachers. So I don't want to, like, paint too negative a picture there, but I had an amazing experience when I was 17, where it was just reading for its own sake and talking about ideas till, like, 4 a.m. with other 17-year-olds. And so when I was 17, I decided I wanted to be a rabbi because I felt like I wanted to preserve this tradition of learning and that Judaism offers that. And I went into academia in part because I wanted to do the intellectual quest that would allow me to be a good rabbi. But I know I'm being long-winded here. But basically, so I went to rabbinical school after Oxford. In some ways that was very much keeping to my 17-year-old self's plan. But in other words, it felt like a change of heart because, I no longer really knew what I wanted to do. And so similar to my experience at Oxford with academia, I kind of didn't really feel like I was such a fit in rabbinical school, and the typical rabbi jobs, like being a congregational rabbi or like a school principal or a camp director. Like, none of those really spoke to me. I think some of that also has to do with denominationalism and not really wanting to put myself in an ideological box, but being more just, like, interested in the experience of learning the text with whoever wants to learn that text, whether they're, you know, much more to the right of me in terms of social conservative values or much more to the, like, left of me in terms of, you know, total disbelief in God or the sanctity of the thing, but just, like, wanting the democratic experience of gathering around the text for the beauty of it. And so I fell into entrepreneurship as a result of the via negativa of not really knowing, like, what to do with all of my different passions. And I've kind of been doing that ever since. There's been a lot of different iterations, but essentially I'm a teacher, a freelance teacher of philosophy and Torah. And I do that through a combination of classes. I used to do in-person events. Since the pandemic, I've mostly pivoted to online. And so I do one-on-one coaching and small group learning, and I write a couple Substacks and have a podcast and kind of have embraced the content creator medium for the time being.
Absolutely. We're going to get into all of that. And I think in particular, we're going to touch on this kind of theme that emerged in that explanation, which is you're kind of this bridge between these two worlds, the secular, the intellectual, and then the religious or the spiritual. And you have a great piece on that. We'll get to that a little bit later. I want to start closer to the beginning, though, with your time in academia. You alluded to the reasons why you left academia. And I know in one of your writings, you also mentioned the peer review process. And so I'm curious if we could start there, actually. What is your take on the peer review process and it as a means of arriving at knowledge, and how can we improve it?
Yeah. So there's been a lot on peer review in the science world recently that's been critical, and I don't really have the expertise to comment on that. But I would make a distinction between peer review in, let's say, the hard sciences and peer review in the social sciences and the humanities, because I think that if you're doing something that is quite objective and measurable, then at its best, peer review can help. I'm not saying it can't be corrupted, but I can see the appeal. I think when what you're doing is engaging with philosophical or literary ideas, it doesn't make sense to frame what you're doing in terms of knowledge. Or to say it differently, maybe knowledge is one thing that humanists do, but there should be other avenues for ways of engaging with the tradition. And academia doesn't emphasize those other ways. It kind of has a science envy. And I think that is bad for the output of the humanities, and it alienates students and people who would otherwise have a lot to learn from great books, because the more you go into the higher up you go in academia, the more specialized you become. And so I think that specialization is probably important, let's say, for chemistry or physics. But I think that for the humanities, there should be some room for being a generalist. And that's, I didn't have the words for it at the time, but I think one of my issues was that I wanted to be a generalist in a world of specialists. And so peer review, in a way, just surfaced the fact that I didn't belong because I didn't want to play that game. So I don't want to necessarily say it's peer review is bad per se, but it wasn't for me. I think there's stylistic constraints to writing an academic article that are not well designed from a user experience. The goal is to please other academics rather than to make the ideas sing or to make them personal or to show what the stakes are. And I find that to be problematic. Of course, having two people who read your work and take a year to get back to you and who have egos doesn't help. And I had a negative experience with peer review where, like, my dissertation was submitted to be a book at Oxford University Press. I had one peer reviewer like totally trash it. And that was very dispiriting. Thankfully, I didn't really want to be an academic at that point. But like, if I did, like, I think that would have been a very crushing experience. And it seems unfair that one person should have so much power over something that is in a way subjective, because like the critique wasn't "you're wrong and here's why." It was like, "You didn't write about Nietzsche. You know, say more about Nietzsche. Why? Because I'm an expert in Nietzsche and like you're my audience." So it's just like, it feels kind of arbitrary.
The incentives are certainly misaligned there. Your dissatisfaction with academia and with the peer review process ultimately has led you to Substack and podcasting as your primary mediums for, or megaphone, if you will. It's kind of replaced that process of publishing within academia. What do you feel like it offers you that publishing at a university can't? But then on the flip side, what do you feel like is still missing when you're publishing through these mediums?
Good question. I feel like Substack for me is kind of like a diary where I can do pencil sketches of my intellectual life. And it's a forcing function because I don't always read as much as I want to, but having to write kind of makes me go into an intellectual state of mind where I either read in preparation for it, or I kind of have to just dig deeper into the wellspring of stuffed, you know, further down in my memory. And I like having that accountability of I'm going to put out a couple pieces a week. I think it's energizing to get feedback from people I know and people I don't know. As a result, like I get so many cold emails from people all over the world, and I find that very energizing. Obviously, the turnaround time when you're publishing in academia doesn't allow for that, and also like the distribution is it's not targeted at anyone; it's targeted at people in the academic guild. In terms of podcasting, I think both Substack and podcasting give me a kind of creative freedom to be me and to not have to color in the lines. And like I could color in the lines if I wanted to, but it would torture my soul too much. So I've kind of just embraced my sloppiness as I've gotten older. And there seems to be more permission outside of academia to just have lots of different interests and not be so buttoned up. In terms of like what's missing, I think I used to feel this, though maybe I've sold out more and so I don't feel the tension as much, but like there is a certain rigor in academia that you just find from hardcore people that put in, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day, like reading things that nobody else reads and like have a facility with, you know, primary text in the original languages and like are just like sitting there doing the hard archival work and discovering things. And that's amazing. And so, yeah, I think there is like a real dedication at its best in academia. And like what I'm doing is kind of superficial in a way. It's more, it's popularizing, it's populist. So I think it definitely depends on what the goal is. But since my goal is less knowledge and more like moving people, I'm not anti-knowledge, but like I think if like I would like to create an experience of thoughtfulness and awe rather than, let's say, there's a fact or a theory I want people to know. So I'm not evangelizing for a fact or a theory. Because of that, it just doesn't make sense to write monographs. Like I visualized my life when I was at Oxford, like what does success look like within this paradigm? I'm a tenured professor at Harvard. I've written 25 books. I won every award. I'm traveling the world, like speaking at universities. And I was like, I don't think that's a good life for me. Like, even if I could get there, which, you know, no guarantees, but like, I'm also not going to get there because like, I don't really feel authentic putting out this kind of content. Anyways, you know, the world doesn't really need another book on Heidegger.
Right. Yeah, you do an excellent job of incorporating those more academic elements into your work, even though it comes across in a more emotional and spirited way. So I think you do an excellent job at balancing it. This may be a function of you. You had a beautiful line in there where you said something to the effect of, I view these mediums as sketches for my intellectual pursuits. So maybe that is the answer to this question, but you are an incredibly prolific creator. This month you'll create on the order of 10 essays across your two Substacks and 3 or 4 podcast episodes. That is a lot of work. How do you do that in addition to this isn't your 9-to-5, so how do you do that in addition to all the other things you have going on?
I thought about that question a lot. One answer is that I've come to a point in my life where like podcasting or writing will require as much time and space as I give it. So if I give it 10 hours, it takes 10 hours. But if I give it 1 hour, it takes 1 hour. And I'm not always happy with having to give it short shrift, but like I can write in any environment. I can write on 3 hours of sleep. I can write while my kids are crying in another room. I can, you know, write at a bus station. So I have a certain ability to work from anywhere, at least with the writing, that helps. And then not being a perfectionist helps a lot. I don't have no standards, but I'm pretty aware that I'm not hitting it out of the park every time. but that as long as it's good enough, like I'm keeping the momentum. So I think there's a muscle memory for just putting yourself out there. Like when I first started my newsletter, it was very intimidating to send it out to a bunch of people. And my first email went out to like 565 people. And like I saw the names of like the people reading my thing, and it was like, oh my goodness, like that person opened my email, like, gosh, like I don't want to think about that. And now I send it out to like 6,000 people, and it's like, should be more intimidating in a way, but just by doing it sort of exposure therapy, like more, I just try not to think about it. So actually like being busy with other things has in a weird way made it easier to produce, because it just like, just do it and don't think about it is a better strategy than like agonize over it. The last point on like just content is like compounding. Like if you read a book every week for many years and you have a decent memory or a decent way of like keeping track of that, like it really does create a nonlinear value or network effect or whatever, where like that book cross-references with everything else you've read and seen. And so I've just been doing this now for a while. Like I'm not Tyler Cowen, you know, he's 58 and he reads like 10 books a day. But in a way, like because when I was in the academic, I was super hardcore. I was reading like 4 to 6 books a day. I kind of like coast off of some of that since in the past 5 or 10 years, I've definitely, you know, I'm not feeding my tank as much, but I have like reserves.
That was part of the answer I was expecting you to give. It comes across that you consume a lot, and a lot of the timeless books. It's not, you do a very good job of combining some of the timeless information with some of the more modern concepts like Tyler Cowen's book on talent or AI. But it comes across very clearly that you're also a prolific reader. Getting into religion and spirituality and Judaism, and this is difficult to do, but doing your best to disentangle your upbringing, your childhood environment, why has Judaism resonated with you above all the other religions or sects you could have participated in?
Right. So my first answer is not the answer you're looking for, but I'm going to say it anyways, which is like, I don't necessarily believe in getting outside of your upbringing or identity and like looking at all the options with the sort of neutral, unbiased objectivity and saying this is the best one. Like part of the appeal is that it's mine, that it's been given to me, and that I can trace that back for thousands of years through a family tradition. And so separate from the merits of Judaism relative to the merits of other traditions, like I feel a sense of responsibility to continue this one because this is the one I was born into. And I think that Judaism, in terms of its content, also would agree with that. That, in other words, there's like a moral and ontological salience to something being given to you and that being a reason to commit to it, not just that you happen to like it or agree with it.
Can we dig into that a little bit more?
Sure.
Is there any conflict between, let's call it, obligation and the pursuit of truth that arises from that?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. But like, I don't really feel that Judaism is making truth claims that disagree with other truth claims. It's more a way of being for me. So I believe it's a good way of being. I mean, this I believe, like people who have the ability to engage with a tradition in a way that where it isn't coercive, but where it's empowering, I think are just in a profoundly privileged position. There are very few people in that position because most of the way that religion is expressed in the world, it's often what's called heteronymous, like people are sort of accepting it because of, you know, punishment or social ostracization or, you know, fear of God doing something to them or, you know, whatever it is. But on the liberal side, like I think most people I know are just very unmoored. from any sense of tradition. And I don't think that that's good either. So like, essentially there's like a small center in the Venn diagram where you're trying to get traditionalism without the, you know, the damaging effects of being traditional. And I'm not saying that that like makes total coherent sense. Like there's definitely some cognitive dissonance and, you know, compromise and think like, it's not seamless, but it's deeply meaningful. I don't think there's anything that I believe that I would posit as like scientific truth that contradicts my religion. But I've had enough religious experience to feel like I'm willing to stake my life on the existence of a benevolent God who wants me to live a purposeful life. And in my case, living a purposeful life means living it within the framework of a Jewish orientation. But I see no reason why somebody couldn't live a purposeful life within the orientation of a Islamic or Christian or Hindu way of being. And I hope that like sort of at a meta level, if you in each of these traditions, there's an opportunity for someone to sort of model that centrist approach that's trying to simultaneously be committed to something that has longevity and also not being a medievalist, so to say.
Yeah, that's a fascinating reconciliation of those two ideas that I think a lot of people or at least traditionally might think as opposites, but aren't necessarily. So I like the way you describe that. At least in the West, for the last several decades, religion has been on the decline. Yet people are obviously seeking certain replacements for aspects or attributes of religion. We have self-help, astrology, fitness. People are seeking father figures like Jordan Peterson. Why are people increasingly non-religious, yet they are looking for elements of religion?
The reason why people are looking for elements of religion is because you got to serve someone, as Bob Dylan said. There's the need for meaning nature abhors a vacuum. Like people are going to fill that need for meaning with anything that at all hits that. And there's so many dimensions to it, from the community piece that you get even in online culture to the service piece that you get in, let's say, effective altruism. I think the sense of a canon or a shared set of ritual that Emile Durkheim in the 19th century called the collective effervescence, that you can even get that in a CrossFit, right? Knowing what the sort of the moves are, or a yoga class, Supta Baddha Konasana. It's like, yes, okay, like I'm here. And then I think, right, there's the West in general has a certain self-loathing quality to it. I think that comes out of like our elevation of critique as being enlightened, self-critique. And also we've achieved so much. Like, you know, once you've achieved a lot, like what do? You perfect self-criticism. And so like the Enlightenment was anti-authoritarian, and we've inherited the Enlightenment, and religion is seen as authoritarian. So there's a lot of reasons why people aren't going to go back to their religion of origin, but somehow they've deluded themselves into thinking, oh, if I just, you know, so I grew up Christian, then Christianity is bad, but somehow like, if I just recite these sutras, like that has no baggage whatsoever. But like, if you go to Nepal or wherever, you know, India, you're going to find the same domination structures that you found in your own religion, because like, right. I see that as not a religious problem, but a human problem. That's like a governance problem. I mean, these traditions are super complex and dialectical, and we only got modernity and liberalism because of religious foundation. Like those ideas come out of a biblical tradition. It's not to say that's the only way you're going to get there, but like we're way too overgeneralizing and black and white about like religion, good or bad, in my view. I know saying that is overgeneralizing, but so that's why people aren't religious. That's one reason why people aren't religious, is because they had a bad experience, or because they inherited a certain anti-dogmatic dogma, or they're self-critical of anything Western. But then they're looking to Goop and CrossFit and you know, effective giving or what, you know, weightlifting and the alt-right folks who are like into like eating raw egg, or what, right. you know, like supplements and all of that. Like I'm saying, like, there's all these like sort of subcultures, that are trying to reconstruct what religion offers. And yeah, I think that's better than nothing in a way. I'm not as critical of it as, let's say, Tara Burton in her book, Strange Rites, who came on my podcast. But like, if you have a 2,000-year-old tradition, like, why would you exchange that for one that was, you know, invented 5 minutes ago? I suppose, like, if you were born in the time of Jesus, like, that religion was also born 5 minutes ago. So maybe say, no, like, this one's different. This one will, you know, has a long runway. It's going to have a 10,000x return, and I'm an early adopter. But I kind of feel like we're always chasing the shiniest new thing, and focus more on novelty than sustainability. And since my religion has been good to me, like, I feel like I want to be an advocate for it, basically.
That's a very personal question for me, because I grew up non-denominational Christian, kind of separated from the church in my later teens, but more recently have found myself attempting to create my own bundle of religion through all of these means that we just alluded to. And so I've started to wonder if religion is on the horizon for me again, whether it's a return to Christianity or finding something else. But there's a lot of truth in the idea of us attempting to recreate or reassemble this religious perspective when we have something that's been around for millennia that we inexplicably separated ourselves from. Mm. So fascinating to think about that a little bit more. What are, digging in on that a little bit further, what are some of the important knock-on effects you think we're seeing as a result of people becoming increasingly non-religious or seeking these alternatives to religion?
It's difficult to say what's the cause and what's the effect. I don't know that I could tell a totally true story of how the loss of religion leads to X, Y, and Z. But I would say it's part of a cluster of things that are not great, in my view. I mean, it's a sociological fact that religious people tend to have more children. So I would say, like, lower birth rates in the West is bad, in my view, because having more children leads to a younger population, which leads to more innovation and more optimism. And aging populations are both a sign of and a driver of decadence. So I think religious people tend to be more optimistic. Not to say there aren't religious doomers. But I think believing that, like, there's a plan for the world and God is benevolent will probably lead you to take certain risks, and do things that feel kind of self-transcendent, for the sake of a higher thing. So, like, I think having children, for example, is some, like, it's a very meaningful, positive experience, but I don't think that, that's the reason to have the children. I think, like, there's a kind of moral obligation, if you can, to push yourself to go from no children to one child, or one to two, or two to three. Like, I feel like a lot of people don't want to have kids because it's hard. And I suppose if they feel that way, they shouldn't, because their kids will come into the world unloved. So that's a problem too. But, like, when I think of religion and the highest order, like, if for nothing else, just seeing religious people's homes, and the love that a religious family has for its children. Again, it's not to say that there's definitely abuse and psychological disorder in all kinds of homes across the board. But, like, when I think of religion at its finest, it's like a playbook for having a good family. And I think that family life isn't a total mess in the West, in terms of, like, high divorce rates, and fewer children and just more broken homes. And like there was recently, like, who is it? Neil Ferguson just put out an article on Bloomberg about like, because there's been all this stuff written about like deaths of despair and rising sort of depression and anxiety rates amongst the young. And Neil Ferguson made the argument that like the young aren't more anxious and more depressed because they're on Instagram, which is like Jonathan Haidt's point. Like they're anxious and depressed because like their parents are anxious and depressed. And like everybody's anxious and depressed. Like, okay, like there's higher, let's say, suicide rates amongst teenagers than amongst adults. But in general, like the trends all correlate. And so if I had to guess, like I would say religious people would probably buck that trend.
I want to dig a layer deeper and better understand, why is it that you think people are averse to religion? Has it just become stigmatized? Is it a desire to, I think there's been a cultural trend towards an aversion of obligation or commitment. We prefer to, you know, be digital nomads and have new partners every week. Why is it exactly that people don't want religion in its traditional sense?
I would distinguish those who didn't grow up with it from those who did. I think those who grew up with religion probably reject it because they had a bad experience, just as people who grew up secular and had a bad experience become converts. You know, bad things happen and they're done in the name of religion, or they're done in the name of God, or they're done by somebody who holds a religious authority, and that sours the soup and makes it impossible to, let's say, psychologically make a distinction between this was a bad actor or a misrepresentation of the tradition. But I'm not going to let that represent the entirety of it. So I would say, like, in some ways, rightful distrust of misapplication of religion. Misapplication maybe is the wrong way to put it, but like religion hasn't always been a force for good in the world. Some people have experienced that directly, and some people have not experienced that directly, but are sort of aware of that being the narrative in their family story from 2 to 4 generations back, or they read the newspaper, they watch the television, and they see, you know, abuse in the Catholic Church. They see like ISIS. Like they turn on the news and like Israel, they see like settlers like burning homes. And they're like, I want nothing to do with any of that. So I think that religion doesn't have the best PR. One answer. I think another is, this depends on which religion you are, but like, I'm just going to riff here. I'm probably going to get canceled for like half the things I'm going to say, but like, I think there's been brain drain from religion. That creates a vicious death spiral, where those who lead are not the best and brightest. And those who are the best and brightest don't want to stay. They want to go and do something else. And over generations that compounds, and the best and brightest now don't even have the literacy or the commitment. And so the ones who are staying tend to be the ones, who get a kind of protection, job security, or, you know, whatever it is. And so like in the Middle Ages, like the best and brightest were like philosopher priests, and philosopher rabbis. Like think of Maimonides. Would there be a Maimonides today? Or like, would Maimonides like just be an amazing, like celebrated doctor at Mount Sinai Hospital who like learn on the side? Yeah. We hope there would still be a Maimonides, but like we haven't necessarily created the incentives to reward him. We've kind of diminished his status in a way. So that's another reason I think why religion is not so popular, is that it doesn't have the best advocates and leaders. And then I also think it's demanding. That answer is not so easy to sort of parse, because like CrossFit is also demanding in a way. Like people are totally happy to sort of be sadomasochists for like fitness and like do like fasts and juice cleanses and whatever, but somehow like keeping kosher, it's like, oh no, that's like, why would you do that? Or like keeping Shabbat, like, yep, yeah, like God forbid, like Do you know what I mean? You plug out in like a rigorous way. So it's like, okay, yeah, like I don't take a phone call on Friday because I keep Shabbat. Fine. Like, yeah, that's good. But I'm saying, I don't know. So I don't think you can just say, oh, it's too demanding. Because people seem like they're into being demanded. They just want it from, somewhere else. I think also, like, obviously, religion's record on liberal values, let's say like women's equality, gay rights, like that's definitely a flashpoint, right now, but these issues predate those specific cultural issues, but like religion is slower to change. It's not as woke, by definition, because it's been around for 3,000 years. So like when you're moving a ship that has 3,000 years of cargo on it, it's not just not going to be as limber as a speedboat. And people want the change and they want it now, and they know better. So it's, I think, it's just very difficult, to get into the mindset that like the ancients might know something that you don't.
Let's pull on that last thread a little bit more. What should religion, and maybe you can use Judaism in particular, be doing in response to cultural change, like a shifting of the Overton window? Should, and maybe the answer is it's case by case, but should it be embracing it, and more kind of flowing with the winds of culture, or should it be steadfast in its traditions?
Yeah, I'm going to say it's case by case. That's like a little bit too general, but I will say two things. One is it definitely should not be captured by contemporary culture, because if it does, it will put itself out of business. It needs to be contrarian. If there isn't a difference between what religion is saying and what like people on the street are saying, then what is it adding? Like if you can go to your church and hear a sermon on global warming, that sermon is going to be less compelling than just going to the global warming rally and hearing from the environmentalist who actually has done the homework, than somebody who's just GPT copy pasting that person's speech and then tacking a biblical verse onto it. So religion definitely needs to be saying something different, needs to be saying it in a different style. At the same time, people shouldn't have such a static view of tradition or religion either, where they kind of are reactive to the fact that there's change going on and therefore dig the heels in. Religion has always been dynamic, and part of its ability to adapt was its ability to take conversations about what's timeless and what changes and facilitate those conversations in a way that minimized the sense of rupture and allowed people to identify with the tradition and with the providential dimension of the tradition, while also realizing that, hey, look, you know, our experience isn't the same as what it was 1,000 years ago, and we have new technology and new social order, and like we can't just sort of pretend that things haven't changed. So like, yeah, I mean, I'm not ultra orthodox, obviously, like I'm here on a podcast with you. Do you know what I'm saying? Like I don't really think that the ultra orthodox way is sustainable from a culture point of view. I think it's sustainable from a birth rate point of view. But I'm not optimistic that the people who are born into poverty, and who aren't given access to, the knowledge of the wider world are going to do well for themselves and find a way to harmonize their tradition. I think it's going to create like massive upheaval. So there has to be a way to do both is basically the answer. But it's for each person and community to find that balance. I don't have a prescription that I'm selling, or a movement that I'm selling. I guess what you would we call like existentialist, in that I think what matters more is the authenticity of the commitment rather than the specifics of the commitment. Like I would much rather people be wholehearted and thoughtful in the way that they engage than to come up with the right answer, so to say.
You're both a scholar of religion and, I guess, more secular philosophy, if you will. What is the lens through which you approach the more secular philosophy? Do you start with kind of a Judaic framework and that's how you come to it? Or do you come to it with truly fresh eyes? You look at the different elements, you mix and match, and then attempt to reconcile any differences you see?
It's difficult to answer that. I would kind of defer to others to answer it on my behalf. But like, it's a complicated question because within philosophy itself, I would say there's a debate as to what, and this goes back to something you asked before, whether you should start from fresh eyes or whether you should actually accept, in Gadamer's terms, your prejudice as a condition for the possibility of understanding. So I think that I start with a particular rather than the universal. I don't think I'm totally neutral. I think I have a point of view already. But in a way, having that commitment allows me to, weirdly enough, be more open or something and feel like more affinity with variety and diversity than if I was in a state of having to choose, where maybe I would feel anxious. Like, if I'm being pulled here, then I'm not being pulled there. I do feel like I have a certain anchor. But that being said, like, I do feel like there's not enough religious Jews or religious Christians or religious Muslims who are like engaging, let's say, deeply with contemporary, with the past 150 years of philosophy. And I think most people engaging in philosophy are sort of post or non-religious. There are exceptions, but I want to be a bridge between those worlds. And for me, it feels like seamless in a way, but I realize that I'm kind of a sociological outlier.
You mentioned the bridge again, so let's get into it this time. You have a beautiful piece called Art is the Bridge Between the Secular and the Religious. I don't want to dig into it so much that I preclude people from going and actually reading it. So I would encourage everyone to read it. But you say in there, and you've said on this episode, that your existential calling is to be a bridge between, or translator between, these two worlds. What does it mean to be that bridge, and where do you feel that that calling originated from? And maybe the answer is as simple as God, but simple and complex as God.
So the psychological answer is being both lonely and seeking connection at the same time. And I think uniqueness and loneliness come together, and I wouldn't want to compromise on my uniqueness, but it's also no fun being an outcast. And so being a bridge is sort of a way to do both by having a variety of things that you're connected to. It differentiates you because other people are sort of not living at that intersection. But then by being a go-between, you kind of find a way to make allyship and solidarity with people anyways, because you see that they have their own uniqueness. I think if I was like giving a self-analysis, like maybe it's the fact that like I grew up in a secular town going to public schools, but I also study with Orthodox tutors. And so I sort of lived in both worlds discursively. And so I want to bring those together for the sake of my own integrity. There's a teaching in the Bible that sort of, there were two creations. There's one in which the man was created by himself, and one in which he's created with a partner already. And that's kind of what I was saying before, is like, and this is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik commenting on it, that there's a calling to the human being to be alone and distinct, and there's a calling to be sort of in friendship. Like, I feel that every single person should find their unique voice, and I want to help people do that.
I want to zoom out for a second and shift a little bit over to philosophy. Kind of a bigger question to start is, what is the objective of philosophy and maybe of studying philosophy? Is it intellectual stimulation? Are the aims actually to improve, like, practically day-to-day our lives? Is it a little bit of both?
I think different philosophers will tell you different things. I think the classical answer is that you're seeking what's true, And that if you know what's true, both about the world and about human condition, that will also be of practical benefit to the good life. But one of the classic tensions in ancient philosophy is between what's called the vita contemplativa and the vita activa, the contemplative life and the active life. So the purists will say that the reason to be a philosopher is simply because the contemplative life is the best life. And you shouldn't even worry about smashing your KPIs or OKRs. Like if you're putting philosophy to such a sort of short-termist and instrumentalist test, then you're already like missing what's sort of dignified and amazing about it. And by the way, like if you think about Aristotle thought that philosophy should be pursued and could only be pursued by those in leisure, which in his time was basically just aristocrats. You can think of why the vita contemplativa would be not available to most people, because most people have to work and have to be practical. And so in a weird way, like if we accept Aristotle's claim, then you get to the modern age, our contemporary moment, and like many people have means, and yet they're so enamored of the vita activa that it's arguable if they could even access the vita contemplativa despite being multimillionaires. And that was part of Heidegger's critique of modernity, was that like we just don't know how to philosophize because we don't know how to relate to anything non-instrumentally. Like everybody's like, okay, what's the ROI case for that? It's like, no, like philosophy doesn't have an ROI case. Anyways, so that would be the purest answer, is that there's no, it's just intrinsically worth doing. And anybody who's had a taste of it knows that. It's kind of like the kingdom of heaven on earth. The practical answer for, you know, why do philosophy? I think there's a range of answers, but like one is it leads to skepticism about your priors. It teaches you to challenge your assumptions and other people's assumptions, and that's probably good for the scientific method, for example. It's not great for, let's say, social cohesion, but it's good for moral and technical progress, maybe. Right? There was a time when we did human sacrifice. Now we don't. Maybe one reason why we stopped doing it is because a philosopher asked, is it really the case that the gods want us to be doing that? And how would we know if they did? And nobody could give a satisfying answer, and so we stopped. I mean, again, I don't necessarily believe that, but there's a range of answers that have been given as to why do philosophy. My own personal answer is philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom. It's the quest for wisdom. It's not the achievement of it. It's not the arrival at a specific worldview or a specific systematic theory that holds it all together, called consilience. I don't think philosophy can offer consilience. And often when it does, I think the consilience it offers is a kind of idol. Like it's a false utopia. It's the experience of everything hanging together, but it doesn't actually. It's just that almost like, you know, when you hear a crazy person sort of talking about how everything relates to everything in that like conspiratorial way, like I think that's where philosophy kind of becomes QAnon. And so I more prefer philosophy as this paradoxical thing of questing for wisdom and holding it at an arm's distance, because you realize that the available answers on offer are sort of not up to snuff.
I think that ties into your piece on what is a fragment that I highly recommend people take a look at. A follow-on question there is, how do we get more people engaged with philosophy? Is it that we're so consumed with the quote unquote active life that we don't make time for it? Is it so obscure? Is it jargon heavy? There's a lot of context behind it that you have to understand before you can really engage with it. And should we even care about getting more people into philosophy? I think I know your answer on the latter, but also curious on how we might do that, what the barriers are.
I think everybody should be more introspective. And that everybody would benefit from thinking more deeply about why they do what they do and think what they think. I also believe that great people have written a lot on these things and spent a lot of time engaging with them. And so it would behoove us to pick up those thinkers rather than just try to do it ourselves, especially when a lot of that work has already been done quite deeply. And secondly, even though the tradition doesn't necessarily come up with consensus, just knowing what's out there allows you to add your voice to that tradition and to be part of that cosmic conversation. So in a weird way, like my argument before about religion is very much the same for philosophy, which is like, it's a tradition. Forget whether it's true, like just appreciate the fact that like Hannah Arendt in 1950 was responding to Plato in 400 BC. And like, that's time travel. And yeah, Zoom is cool, but like, have you tried, like, have you tried picking up the phone and like calling Aristotle? Now, like, he doesn't really talk back, but he also does, I think. I don't think it's just solipsism and narcissism and you stare at the text and you get back from it what you think. Like, it literally enlarges your mind and you realize like, oh, like, I'm not just like the thoughts in my skull. Like I exist within a given world that has been built by other people, and I'm going to die one day. And what do I want to give to people that are going to come in 2000 years for me? So I agree that philosophy has a lot of jargon and is difficult and dense. And like, I don't necessarily recommend picking up Kant if you want to get a flavor for philosophy. Although I think Plato's dialogues are quite good and quite readable. But it's important to know what Kant thought. So unfortunately, he was a terrible writer. So I think, in other words, getting the specialist's view on the tradition is not for everyone, but engaging with the ideas themselves is for everyone. And I think, right, the way to get more people engaged is to create opportunities for this reflection that doesn't require, let's say, being super academic or spending, you know, 4 years of your life like banging your head against a text. That being said, like, if you're smart enough to like learn computer science at like Stanford or, you know, whatever, like, you're probably smart enough to like learn Kant, but there's like an assumption that this stuff doesn't matter. Because like, it didn't, you know, what does it do? And by the way, when I say there's an assumption, like, I think there's an assumption by young people. Older people realize that they get less arrogant. In my experience, like 40 and up, and people are like, oh yeah, it's important to know what Kant thought. But like, your 25-year-old who's like, just like raised a Series B, isn't. Like, just doesn't care, essentially. So they'll learn.
Has philosophy, and I hesitate to use this word, has philosophy progressed over millennia? And is that something we should even be thinking about for the field, as like a metric for the field? Are there substantively, we're dealing with foundational questions about existence and knowledge and being, a lot of the perspectives that were shared thousands of years ago are more or less the same ones that we're still talking about today. Has there been substantive progress, and is that even the right way to look at the field?
Philosophy has progressed towards self-cancellation. It went from believing that there was something that we could know that would be world-changing to culminating in pragmatism, which is essentially the idea that what matters is what we can do rather than what's true. And postmodernism, which questions every grand narrative and says that it's all essentially a construct and a function of language rather than of reality. So in a way, philosophy arrived at its own self-diminishment. It's kind of like a mandala, you know, in the Eastern tradition where you build this elaborate thing and then you destroy it. I'm kind of cool with that. Like, I don't know if that's progress, though. I feel like, okay, and then you return. You know, then you go back. That being said, Agnes Callard defines philosophy as conceptual literacy. She thinks Socrates sort of was the inventor of conceptual literacy. And if you go with that definition, then we've become more conceptually literate and more people have gained conceptual literacy. And just like the internet, which started as this super niche thing, and now a lot of people are on it, and maybe one day everybody will be on it. And that's going to radically change the way that we relate to one another and the knowledge that we have accessible. So conceptual literacy is kind of like the internet, where it's this common language that can cut across time and place and tradition. So from that point of view, yes, there's progress because more people speak this language that once upon a time only Socrates spoke, and Socrates was put to death for doing it. And now, like, there are philosophy departments.
I would kick myself if I had a rabbi here and didn't ask this question, however simple and trite it might be. What's the meaning of all this, this experience, this life?
The first answer is to figure out what the meaning is. You weren't put in this world and given the manual. You were put in this world, and especially being born in the modern time, and you have to figure out what is the manual. So it's like one of those games where the object of the game is to figure out the rules by which the game is played. And, you know, perhaps even to figure out what winning means, if winning is even an appropriate thing to say. That's a nice non-answer. But I personally can tell you what it means to me. I don't know if I could say that this is definitively what it means for everybody, but like, I have conviction that there is such a thing as the soul. That my life doesn't begin when I'm born and doesn't end when I die. I can't really tell you much more about what the soul is and what that even means. But, you know, Plato thought, or Socrates thought, that the soul was immortal. Again, like, that is kind of incoherent to me. I don't know what that immortality of the soul means. But I generally agree with the sentiment that, like, while we're here on Earth, we think it really matters that we're here on Earth, and we need to, in a way, bracket that fact. But from another point of view, like, we're here to go on an earthly experiment as spiritual beings and contribute something and fix something and learn something and heal and experience drama and agony and grow. There's an idea in the Jewish tradition that some people gain redemption over a lifetime and others gain it in a moment, in a single moment. So like, right, some people work really hard day after day, banging their head against the wall, and it adds up. And other people are just sort of fortunate that they get that epiphany. I think the same is kind of true for your purpose. Like, some people know what their purpose is and they just are aligned with it. And other people, like, it takes an emergency in a sense to bring it out. And that could be just a very normal person who doesn't think of themselves as a leader. And all of a sudden, like, they're Nazi Germany and it's like, are you going to hide some Jews in your house or are you not? Like, heroism is an option that also can situationally arise. So I think the meaning of all of this, though, is to kind of be heroic, basically, to go on a hero's journey and do something that no other person could do. And that you either know what that is or you have to clarify what that is through trial and error. But the world will bring it out of you.
In closing, I always ask my guests the same final question, which is, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about, to ruminate on, or to act on?
If you could write a message in a bottle and have somebody in 1,000 years open up that bottle and read the message, what would you want it to say?
I want to ask you what yours would say, but I kind of want to leave the mystery. So maybe we'll stop there. Well, Zohar, this was incredible. Definitely going to have you back on if I didn't even get through half my questions. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks so much for having me, Spencer.